Blog Talk Radio.
Here's my introduction.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Well, despite the fact that it's going to thunderstorm and it's cloudy, we're going to have some fun. We are live on the air with the author of The Consultant, T.J. O'Connor, is here. And we're going to find out about one of my new favorite characters, Jonathan Hunter. When a rogue CIA consultant goes AWOL from the Middle Eastern post in response to his brother's plea for help, he arrives just in time to witness his brother's murder. That is scary. For years, Jonathan Hunter and his brother, Kevin Mallory, had not spoken until his final words, Khalifa. And we're going to find out what that means. What happens when you pursue your brother's killer and stumble upon everything and everybody's after you? We're about to find out because T.J. O'Connor is going to tell us. Hi, how are you? Glad to have you here.
Hi, friend. How are you?
Oh, just peachy.
Peachy, yeah, I can tell.
I know. So how did you create Jonathan Hunter? And tell us a little bit about him. And, you know, it's funny because your old publicist sent me the book, and it was sitting and staring at me, and it was begging me. And I saw Jonathan's face, and he said, would you please read me? You've been here long enough. And that's pretty much
well,
how
good
I got
for
it.
Him.
And then yes, he did.
So Jonathan Hunter is, although the book just came out this past May, and I wrote the first draft of it probably 5 or 6 years ago, Jonathan Hunter has been with me, oh my Lord, probably since the mid-80s. I wrote my very first novel right out of high school, and I will tell you that it's a long time ago, you know, about 38 years ago. But it was really bad, so I kind of shelved it, and over the years I kind of worked on different projects. But I kind of fell in love with the character because when I wrote this first book, I showed it to some friends who were with the OSI unit at the time, and they loved him. They didn't like the book very much, and it was terrible, of course, but they really liked him. And so I kept him around for two or three other attempted novels, and over the years he kind of matured. And the very first book I sort of tried to get an agent with. He was the lead character in that book, and he's again, you know, the couple agents that were looking at the story, they didn't pick up the book at the time. Thank God, because I ended up with a fantastic agent, Kimberly Cameron. But they said, hey, this is a really great character. You know, you should pursue this. And I did. So Hunter's been with me almost from the start. But the thing about him that is a little different from most other thrillers or TV shows, I think, is probably that he's the antithesis of most action stars, right? So my agent and I like to say that he's not one of the big J characters. He's not James Bond, Jack Reacher, Jack Bauer, Jason Bourne. It just happens that he's got a J in his name. He's sort of fly by the seat of his pants. He makes up the rules as he goes along a little bit. He's sort of a rogue, and he jokes a lot about himself. There's a lot of self-deprecation in there because he's sort of an average normal guy. And I come from the counterintelligence world. I was a military federal agent for many years. And he's sort of the kind of person that I worked with every day. None of us were superheroes. We weren't, you know, we were pretty good shots. We knew how to use weapons. But we were not the guys that could, you know, shoot a peacock at a mile and a half or anything like that. We were average people that went out and just did the very best we could. And that's sort of who Jonathan Hunter is.
Well, I like Jonathan Hunter. And the problem was that I picked up the book and I'm saying, I don't know if I want to read this. And I picked it up and then I couldn't put it down. And that's just not fair. Yeah, seriously.
Well,
that's
I'm glad to hear
that. That's what's been happening lately. with too many books. No, I just finished The Killing Room by Peter May. Oh my God. And Andrew Gross's book, Button Man, that's coming out. People want to read
that. I've heard about Button Man. I didn't know about May's book, but I look forward to finding it.
May's book, my husband reads nothing that I review. My doctor, I had the extra copy of yours, so my doctor's nurse took it out of my hand. So she's reading consultants, but she also wants Button Man. Nobody's getting that one yet. It's fantastic. But Peter May, it's very gory. Teaches you, if you really read the book, you can do an autopsy, but I won't tell you why. And it's scary. The premise of what this guy came up with is, oh my God. So, Jonathan Hunter, how come you become so many different people? Why so many aliases? Which is really good.
Well, so some of that is theater, and some of it's reality. So, you know, he's a consultant for the CIA, and he's a former Green Beret. So, you know, for business, he takes on the aliases when he travels in the hostile areas so that nobody can figure out who he is. But then I just sort of got a little carried away just to have a little fun with the CIA, right? So when you're in that community, there's so many different types of people. It's like everything else. But there are very few James Bond and Jack Reachers, right? You know, a lot of people will say, oh, yeah, well, these guys are all that way. Well, no, most of them are really average, hardworking folks. And I have the luxury of having a couple of former Special Forces guys, a Navy SEAL and several Green Berets that I work with in my normal job. And talking with them and hearing their stories, that helped me refine who he was. And one of the things we always joked about was aliases. So I decided in the story that I would, you know, I would give him too many aliases as sort of a tongue-in-cheek approach to his character. And in the very first few pages, he goes on about how he leaves one country as Jeremy Kelly. He arrives as Martin Levinson, and he transforms into Christopher James. And eventually, when he finally gets back home, he's Jonathan Hunter, which is really not his full name. So it's sort of a play on that culture, but at the same time, it sort of explains why his brother could never find him and nobody really knew where he was.
Well, I'm just back over here. Tell us about Kevin and what happens to him. I mean, how do you feel when you see somebody that you care about or really haven't spoken to in a while, and then he dies right in front of you? Why did he come over there? Why did he do that?
Well, so that's really the focus of how this story gets going. Hunter has been an expatriate his entire adult life. He and his brother Kevin had a falling out when Jonathan left to join the Special Forces. And over the years, they rarely talk. So what I was trying to create was this vacuum for Hunter, that the reason he's been sort of a rogue expatriate is because he just gave up on home and he gave up on family, and off he is being an adventurer and a swashbuckler and all this. And he comes to a very abrupt change when he returns home, and in the very opening pages, his brother is murdered right in front of him. And he came home because his brother summoned him, and he believed he was coming home to mend fences, to fix things with Kevin. But you don't find out what's really going on until the last few pages. That's part of the truth, but that's not the entire truth. And it starts a collision of two different things going on when he finds Kevin. First of all, Kevin releases a little tidbit of evidence that leads Hunter down the trail of these terrorists, but it also reveals a lot of things about Kevin himself. So you don't know much about Kevin throughout the book, except you find out that he is a Bureau of Criminal Investigations agent for Virginia, which is the state-level FBI. And he's been on a case that ends up erupting in front of him in the opening chapter. But Kevin's also married to Noor and has adopted an Iranian refugee teenager. And Noor is a refugee. So it starts out, here's this guy, this rogue adventurer, Jonathan Hunter, who's been traveling the world fighting terrorism and confronting radical Islam and radical terrorist groups. And he comes home and he finds out that all these years he's been over there fighting a fight that is right back in his hometown. And it startles him. He's like, oh my God, I've been over there doing this. And the problem is as much at home as it is over there to some degree. And then he comes smack dab in the face of, and his brother married this beautiful Iranian refugee and has adopted this Middle Eastern boy. And he's not only startled, but he doesn't know what to do with that. So that starts to fuel his desire. Not only does he want to find his brother's killer and find out not only who's responsible, but what caused it all, but he's also coming to grips with being this family member who has been gone his whole life. And he's trying to make amends between those two worlds. And not only does it cause controversy, but it causes a lot of laughs because he is so inept at family and relationships. It causes him a lot of problems in the story. And I won't even go into some of those because they're relatively humorous, and he trips over himself constantly.
We know. And we won't say what he gets into. I know. Some of those scenes were like, are you seriously going to do that? But we won't say that. So we've got the FBI and somebody that was not very nice, David Bond. Why does he like Hunter, and why does he want to take him down? And then how and why did you decide that? Well, we have the refugees there. We just said that. But why does he want to take him down?
So,
like,
you know, over the years, I've been both a military federal agent and an independent consultant myself. I've been in the consulting business since about 1993, and prior to that, I was a military federal agent. And I've worked with local law enforcement my entire life. My son is actually a local police officer, and I work with cops and feds all the time in my profession as a anti-terrorism consultant. And, you know, despite what you see on TV, right, the cops are not the bad guys. You know, like any profession, you have some that are bad, you have some that do bad things, and you have the ones that just make mistakes. So I'm not cop-slaming by any means, but not everybody's perfect. So I created David Bond, who's a local police deputy detective who was working with this FBI terrorism task force. And David has been involved with Kevin. They've been best friends for years, since before Kevin was married, and he gets involved with Kevin over the years, and then also meets Noor and sort of has a connection to Noor that, and I won't go into what that is, but there becomes this triangle of families. You've got David Bond, a local police detective who's insanely jealous of Hunter when he realizes that that Hunter is Kevin's brother. Nobody knew that Kevin that Kevin had a brother. Nobody even knew that Hunter existed. And now all of a sudden, he's family with Noor, and Bond wanted that role. So from the very beginning, there's a collision personally. But there's also a professional collision, because Bond is a sheriff's deputy detective, and he's sort of trying to keep his status with the task force. And all of a sudden, here's this rogue guy shows up, and he refuses to play by the rules, and he refuses to cooperate. And they're just at loggerheads instantly. It's like two bulls in the ring, and they're just going to fight it out. And sometimes it makes absolutely no sense at all until the end of the story.
Oh, but that part, I'm not going to tell you if I figured it out. But there was one thing I did figure out, and I was like, yeah, okay. And I realized it, but it was really, that ending was like, whoa. And that was a harsh revelation for a lot of people, and that's all I'll say about that.
You know, I'll add to that a little bit. One of the things I try to do with all my books, including the paranormal mysteries that I wrote, was, and I've been criticized for this, and I'll admit it, I have a lot of characters, and there's a lot of twists and turns, but I always give the reader something that they can figure out, that it's not a complete red herring. You know, because when I read a book, if I get to the end and I know absolutely nothing about what's happening, I get frustrated. So I always try to leave two or three things that they can say, oh, yeah, I knew that, and then the rest of the twists come so that there's a little give and take with the reader about what was easy to figure out and what is a complete shock.
Well, considering I've read over 8,000 mystery thrillers.
Wow.
I was proud of myself. Yeah, I did, yeah.
And wow.
This is, yeah, I'm serious. My husband went, he just bought me a new computer, and he's not letting me use it unless I learn, you know, I don't know why. But he likes it better. And I have my little Mac here, and he counted how many reviews I have. It must be close to 8,500 now since he told me that. And I said, do I have to delete any? I have to start deleting stuff because, you know, you do it once and you do it twice, and then I save it 1,000 times until the computer that I went to read, find a review of a book I read the other day, a while ago, and I can't find it. Oh, well.
It's
a really good book, but for some reason I didn't write it under the title, so yeah. And this was one of those books I said, well, this is credible. I get this. And then there were times, like I just finished a book by a New York Times author. I won't say who. The book was fantastic until the final reveal at the end, and I'm saying the police would never let the criminal go, even if they're attached. So, you know, there were times I said, oh, my God, this. And I knew who did it. But we won't say what it was. So we have another character that's kind of elusive, but he's interesting, who's Oscar LaRue. Is he tied to him? He's afraid of him. And Hunter's not afraid of anything. But when this guy speaks, whoa. And how come he's involved with the Russian intelligence and the Iranian plot? And, you know, these books really let you know who's to be careful about. But, you know, I don't look at people like that. I just look at them as people. Which is probably unique in itself.
Well, Oscar LaRue is also a character that's been with me from the very beginning. He and Hunter together were in the very first book I wrote. But Oscar is near and dear to me for another reason, too. And if your listeners and anybody reading a book wants to know all the backstory, you can go to my blogs. I write about Oscar a lot. Oscar LaRue is really a fellow by the name of Wally Fedorov. Wally was my mentor for about 23 years, and Wally was one of the last OSS operatives from World War II. And as you probably know, there's only maybe a couple dozen left alive in the world. And after that, Wally became the deputy director of the CIA. And when he retired from the agency, he joined the consulting firm that I ended up working for, and I ended up working for Wally. And we became sort of adversarial friends. You know, we had a really great relationship in that we argued and bantered and was constantly back and forth, but it kept us sane. And what an amazing man he was. And he, for some reason, just took me under his wing to be my mentor. And for the next 23 and a half years, we were virtually inseparable. We ate dinner at least, ate lunch or dinner at least a couple times a month the last 10 years.
Oh, nice.
Once a week. And he was he lived by himself. He only had one daughter who lived in California, so I was close. And his demeanor and his idiosyncrasies are exactly Oscar LaRue. I actually asked him permission to capture him so closely because anybody that knew him would read this and go, oh yeah, that's Wally. But the reason I made him the way he is as Oscar LaRue, this sort of combative guy, is that's what Wally was. He was a really powerful guy, and he was mysterious because he was only like 5'7" and very slight, wore these round glasses, and he shuffled when he walked in. Whenever he wanted to make a point, he took his glasses off and started polishing, just like Oscar LaRue. But when he spoke, the room went quiet. And when I was in board, you know, Fortune 500 and Fortune 100 companies in boardrooms doing my, you know, doing the consulting, even if I was speaking, he would take his glasses off and I would shut up and let him talk. And the entire room of power brokers quieted to hear him talk. And he was an amazing guy. So that's who Oscar LaRue is put to print after. And I tried to keep it as close as possible. And the relationship between he and Hunter is about 95% the relationship that Wally and I had because it was fun. And it was sort of a banter, sort of a combative. But at the end of the day, LaRue gets his way, but he also kind of manipulates Hunter. And Oscar is mysterious in that he doesn't tell Hunter everything. He doesn't play all of his cards. He keeps them very close. He's an old cold warrior. Just like Wally was. And Hunter is, because he's that rogue, fly by the seat of his pants, Oscar knows better than to give him too much. Because if he gives him too much rope, Hunter's going to hang himself with it. I mean, that's just the way Hunter operates. So that relationship of kind of the sort of humorous, sort of serious battle between them, it's real. And I can write it that way because I lived it for, 25 years.
Well, that's what makes it great. You know, I write scary stuff too. And I write behind the characters behind the gravestone because they're dead. And they tell why they got there because they did something awful. And if anybody gets me angry, I kill them off in my book.
There you go.
Seriously? But it's very hard to get somebody to help me to write it. So when it came to writing something about a fire, I tried to use the fire department here, but I wound up doing research, and I know it was accurate because nobody said I was wrong yet. But I'm trying to find someone to help me for my next one. It's based on real-life events, but I'm going to make a fiction. My grandmother was in a Polish sterilization camp. So I'm trying to figure out if it was, I don't think it was World War II. I think it was in between, before she came here. And she told me the story, but I want to make sure that I'm accurate. But I want to know if there's anybody that knows enough about x-raying and what happens when you do something like that. So it should be interesting, though, if I have a five minutes to write it.
Yeah,
yeah,
it sounds interesting.
I'm going to, my grandmother was Katie, but I'm not going to call it Katie. I'm going to call her Esther Rosenbaum, because I don't want everybody to know that it's her. A lot of people don't know the story, and I never knew that she didn't have children, and she just sort of blurted out the truth about certain things. And my mother told me a little bit more, so it should be interesting. And I have pictures, and my grandfather was her savior. He went to the Polish underground and saved her and her sisters. So there's a whole big story there, yeah.
Wow,
so,
fascinating.
Sandtown is where this takes place, the Muslim community. And that's where the bomb goes off. So why did you why is Sandtown, is that a real place?
Well, let me adjust that a little bit. First of all, Sandtown is a very critical thing in the story, but the bomb doesn't go off there. There's no bombings in Sandtown. So Sandtown is actually Sandy Creek, and that's a made up town. It's a made up town, and what I wanted to do was part of the background to the story is what happens in a small town like Winchester, where I live, when terrorism starts happening in your own streets, when the problem is no longer New York City, Washington, D.C., you know, it's here. It's in a small town. And having operated against terrorism overseas in places like Greece and Turkey and other places, you know, there's a lot of small towns. And these people, they're so not really accustomed to it, but it's part of their world so much that they take it in stride, and it's just, okay, there was a bombing. Do you want a cup of coffee? Are you here for lunch?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of the way they take. Now, Americans react very differently than that. And I remember personally on 9/11, the events that took place and the terrible things that happened afterward. Now we're, you know, I'm a flag waver, you know, we're the greatest country there is, and we make a lot of mistakes, and shame on us for some of the bad things that we do, and I'm not going to hide them. They're there. And I wanted to take some of those and sort of make the story part of it as Hunter comes to grip with coming back to the United States and finding his enemy from the Middle East now in his hometown. I wanted to kind of spin that and say, and then there's the part of the hometown that gets ugly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you remember at 9/11, right, at 9/11, the afternoon of 9/11, there were stories hitting the paper, some true, some not, about poor cab drivers being dragged out of their car and beaten up on the street who weren't even Middle Eastern. They were of foreign descent. They were Africans, and they were other folks that the dummies that did it, the criminals who attacked them, were enraged over what happened, but they were blaming the wrong people, and they were acting out really ugly. So I took a couple of those events and kind of twisted them for my own needs in the book and created some events that take place during the book, like when one cabbie is beaten up and his car is torched, and then Sandtown. So what Sandtown is as the refugee situation in this country has grown over the years, a community outside of Winchester is sort of formed accidentally, and although it used to be Sandy Creek, the local folks from the area have nicknamed it Sandtown, because all of the people there are Middle Eastern. And it's meant to be crude. It's meant to be sort of prejudicial. But it's also there as a tool of the story to say, hey, look at how ugly things get. when people don't understand what's going on. And that's sort of the theme of the refugees, too, right? So the refugees are involved in several incidents throughout the story, and I got to be careful because I don't want to give too much away here. But
yeah, you don't want to.
They're involved in these situations and being blamed for other things. But in the end, when the truth comes out as to what's really happening, I hope the reader steps back and go, darn, you know, and starts thinking about we have to be careful how we view things, because what we see is not necessarily what's really happening, particularly in something as serious as terrorism and the repercussions of events. And we've got to be careful we don't pull the trigger too fast, because when you do that, you're wrong most of the time. And that's sort of the backdrop to the story.
No, you know, it's funny because on 9/11, I was in school. And I had just got, I was sent a writing group back to class because I was a writing and reading staff developer and the administrator. And the nurse called me in and she said, you got to see this. We thought we were watching a program. I mean, I literally saw the first tower go down. Then we watched the second tower go down.
Yep.
And then I was like in shock. I mean, seriously. And everybody, not my boss so much, but the rest of us pulled together. And it was really funny because the only cell phone that worked in the school was mine for some stupid reason. And I let everybody use the phone, thank God I had my charger, to call and tell everybody, you know, what was going on. And it was frightening. The saddest part was about a month later when a parent came in to see me and I said, oh, you know, Janine was just here. Janine died. My student died in the first tower. And I, you know what? I had never broke down in my life like that. Oh, my God. So yesterday, you know, 9/11 is enough to remind us that we have to stick together as Americans, and we can't, you know, hate is a terrible word. And I dedicated a whole bunch of poems to her on Facebook, which I can't believe no one read, because it's sad. But we've got Oscar LaRue, and he wants John to find who's responsible for the attacks and what happens when he finds the dead bodies and gets threats everywhere. And that's scary.
It is scary. So, you know, in the beginning of the book, Hunter has not only a conflict with Kevin and everything that's going on, but
he has
left the Middle East, his operation he was on with Oscar, without telling Oscar. He snuck home, basically, to talk to his brother, and then he figured he'd get back in time, everything would be fine, but he didn't. And now he's embroiled in this huge international incident. And he realizes when he finds the first victims, and I won't give you any more detail than to say he finds the victims. And he realizes he's over his head alone. He's got to bring in Oscar LaRue. And it's sort of an oh, my God moment. I got to call this guy, and he's going to be mad, and I'm in big trouble. And he is, because he's violated the rules. But then LaRue realizes he's got a great opportunity to take advantage of this. And then later on in the story, you're going to find out how that really kind of twists and turns, and you ask the question, well, was this planned? Was it not planned? Is it really an accident at Hunter's home? You know, who's really responsible for these events taking place? And that's part of the twists and turns of the story at the end, when you find out who's complicit, who's been duplicitous, and who some of the players are. Some you liked, some you hated, and you find out who's who at the end. And they're not all what you think.
I know. But there's one person, I just crossed out a question because I asked you, I said, who is this person that orchestrated the attacks? We're not going to say, I'm going to cross that one out. But there's another character that I had, Bobby and Sam. How come they were such good friends? And why does Bobby seek out John?
Yeah, so that's...
I don't want to say too much. I cried on that one.
Right. So that was a sort of a bittersweet situation to write about. And so Bobby is this local college kid who's a chess player, self-proclaimed chess expert. And he's sort of stuck himself with Sam. And Sam is Semeh. He is an Iranian, an American, who was adopted by Kevin and Norm Mallory. And you know, Sam A's a troubled kid. You know, he's having a hard time assimilating to Winchester, and he's struggling with not having parents, and now he's adopted, and there's a big story I talk about in there about what happened to Sam A as he was a kid. But he's found this guy, Bobby, and he reluctantly becomes friends with him, and I say reluctantly because it's sort of a hostile relationship. They need each other because they're both outcasts, and what happens to that when Kevin's killed. So he finds out that Bobby's involved or peripherally a witness to what happened to Kevin Mallory in the first chapter, and they seek John out because, in their opinion, you know, police aren't doing enough stuff, and now Hunter's back, and he's this kind of unique enigma of a character. And Hunter sticks himself in the middle of this and says, no, I want to talk to Bobby. I don't care what the police are doing. I'm going to find this out myself because he's my brother and you're my nephew and that's the way it is. And when they start working this kind of interesting introduction, a couple other Middle Easterners show up. There's problems. And slowly but surely, Bobby and Sam A start finding out who Hunter really is, that he's a CIA operative. He's not a businessman like Kevin has told them all their lives. So that's how the relationship starts to get going. It's sort of hostile at first, then it settles down a little bit, but it never quite becomes a friendship. And as the story unfolds, you find out why. And then once again, as you near the end of the story, a lot of things happen to Sam A and Bobby. And at the end, you find out why those things were percolating and why those things never quite reached the point of a friendship.
And that's when I brought out the box of tissues. Seriously.
Well, then I did my job.
You did your job too well. I also got eye strain reading the book, which is a compliment. If I read a book at the end and my eyes are bothering me and I can't read anymore, you're in trouble. That's what happened when I read The Consultant. I mean, the book was literally in my bag looking at me and going, you know, you're a pain in the neck. It's been there a while. Why don't you read it? And that's what happened with your book, and that's what happened with Matt Quayle's book, Blood Truth, and that's what happened with Wrong Light that's coming out in December, which I read. And then I see on Facebook, just for fun, I did it on purpose, just to, you know, I said to Dick Belsky, I said, I have your new book. He says, I don't have it, but I said, but I do. And then I said to D.P. Lyle, I have Sunshine State. He says, wait a minute, how'd you get it so fast? So they're coming on in May.
Yeah, well,
I said, obviously,
Dick is a great guy.
He's fantastic. I saw him at the Thriller Fest. He was great. We sat and chatted and, you know, whatever. And I love D.P. He's a writer.
Yeah, I only know Doug a little bit. You know, I've had a few conversations.
Great.
Of course, we're both represented by the amazing agent Kimberly Cameron, but Doug is a really funny guy and he's a very successful fellow. But he's really a great writer and a nice person to just hang out with. Now, Dick and I, we first got to know each other a couple of years ago, and we've been to a lot of events together. And I've always enjoyed being there with him because we have
he's
a lot
great.
Of fun together. And he's one of those authors that you can tease and we can go back and forth and give each other, you know, a bunch of attitude and just make an event fun as opposed to two stiff authors up there trying to sell their books, right? We enjoy the interaction, and he's really just a great guy to be around.
You know what made me feel good is when he walked over and said hello to me and gave me a hug, and my husband looked at me and says, how do you know him? I'm going, no, I don't know him. He knows me. And then,
yeah, that sounds like
Doug came over and gave me a hug and said hello. A lot of people didn't, and there were some people that, whatever, what can I tell you? And I was one of those people that stood online for 45 minutes just to meet George Martin because my niece wanted the book and the autograph. And only for Danny would I do that. And
yeah,
I
was
disappointed
popular.
Because, yeah, well, I never read his books. And I said, would you like me to review your book? And he looked at me like I had, never mind. He didn't give it to me. What can I say?
Yeah.
Let me tell you, he would do very well coming on my show. What can I tell you? Anyway, before I forget, hopefully, you never know with me, tomorrow Marilyn Levinson is going to be here for Read and Gone. And on Monday, the author of A Flight of the Gray Fox will be here, and that is Gary Bassanite. And on the 20th, the one and only Tom Sawyer, major production.
Oh, wow, you got a great
Tom.
Lineup coming up.
Yeah, I do. I get lucky. But this is going to be the funniest. And she's a trip and a half, and I love her. And she knows me, and it's Nancy Allen and James Patterson's book, Juror Number 3. Wait till you read that. She sent it to me. Actually, she gave it to me, autographed. I was excited. And I'm waiting for James Patterson's supposed to send me an autographed copy. And if they don't, I'm going to be really upset because I gave them their first 5 stars yesterday. I did. On the 2nd, TrinityHouseEntertainment.inc, who created the opening for that Rachel and Michael are coming on with some more inspirational music because we need a little love in this world, and they're going to do it. And on October 4th, Trish Stevens has multiple sclerosis. We're going to talk about it up close and personal. She asked me to. And finally, on October 8th, the one and only Shannon Kirk, who I actually met in person, who emailed me at the Shula Fest, we need to talk, in the Vines. And on the 10th, people that you know, Ross Clavin, Tim O'Mara, and Charles Salzberg, three strikes. I read that yesterday. That was my eye strain. Yeah, the stories are interesting, but Charles' story was my favorite. What can I say? So we have a few more minutes, and we have Core. What's her thing with this affiliation with John? Why does she want him to get close to her? And who is Kane? And he got me mad.
You kind of cut out there. Did you say Victoria and Kane?
No, Kane and
okay,
Core.
Kane, right.
Kane. See, Kane. Tell us about him. I didn't like him at all.
Yeah, that's good. You shouldn't like him. He's a real wild guy. So Kane is the third and final of the characters that has been with me from the very beginning. And Kane is actually modeled after a couple of bad guys that I was involved with way back in the 80s when I was an OSI agent and I was living in Athens, Greece, chasing bad guys. And what I wanted to do was create a character that was not stereotypically what you would think of in terrorism, right? So this fella he's not a Middle Easterner because too many people associate terrorism only with the Middle East, and there's certainly so many more cultures and things that sponsor terrorism. And he's sort of an Eastern European, not Russian, but nobody's really sure where he's from. He's sort of an enigmatic character. And he's a rogue, and he's known to be an assassin, and he works for the highest bidder, and he's nomadic. So he's all the things that I wanted to have. And the reason I gave him so many of these terrible qualities was because I wanted him to be able to do virtually anything and have people go, oh, yeah, this guy's capable of that. So I didn't want to box myself in with him. So as Kane comes onto the scene, you find out that he is working with three sets of bad guys, if I can, right there, without giving too much away, in the story, and he's duplicitous with all of them. He's playing everybody against everybody, and so he's a mercenary. And Kane becomes significant in the story because Oscar LaRue wants Hunter to find him bad. So Oscar wants Hunter, all right, you're going to find out who killed your brother because that's going to lead us to the terrorist cell. But in the meantime, Kane's involved. You've got to get Kane. And Hunter's like, oh, my God, what else can I do? Can I maybe solve world hunger while I'm at it? You know, is there anything else you want from me, boss? And so he starts going down that road. And as the story progresses, the connections between these two become narrower and narrower until they collide. And when they collide, it's explosive. And you find out the duplicity of everybody involved, and it all circles around Kane and a couple of other mysterious characters. And when I was recently invited to make a presentation to one of my biggest clients, retirees, and they wanted me to give her this book, and I did. And when they were reading the back cover to her, there was a couple people kind of giggling in the audience when they started talking, oh, the Iranians, oh, you've got the Russians, and oh, you've got a murder, and oh, you've got this. So I kind of stopped in the middle and I looked at him and said, do you know anything about terrorism? And they were embarrassed and they went, yeah. I said, well, then you know that all this is going on today, right? And they just kind of stared at me, and I said, nothing is black and white. You know, an event that takes place in Syria, who does it involve? The Americans, the Europeans, the Syrians, the Russians. I mean, everybody's involved. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. So what I wanted to do was take bits and pieces of these people and put them in there. But I needed a focal point. I needed a way to make it realistic that all these entities could be involved in this one major operation. And what would that, and in this case, it's Kane.
I know, he's a scary character, let me tell you. But we won't tell you anything what happens after. Now we have Noor and Kevin, and we have Special Agent. I wasn't crazy about her either. Victoria Beccaro. What is with her, anyway?
Well, Victoria is, she's on her own little mission, right? So
part of
this story is I needed to keep it as realistic as I could, although I took a lot of license with things like most authors do. But I've worked with FBI terrorism task forces before, and to Hunter's shock and amazement, there's one in Winchester. Well, you know, there's task forces around here for other things, but I created one specifically for Winchester because I wanted it in a small town like Winchester to, for people to say, what is a terrorism task force doing in this little town? And that's how all these other events start percolating up. People realize that the FBI knows something that we don't, and that's what causes some of the angst around town. But Victoria Beccaro is the chief of the task force, and she's involved not only with the murder of Kevin, but she takes an instant interest in Hunter because she is startled that she thought she knew everything she needed to know about Kevin, but then she never knew that he had this long-lost brother. So she is instantly suspicious of Hunter. She's instantly suspicious of Noor because with Kevin's death, she is absolutely a suspect, and at the end, you'll find out what her involvement in the murder is. And Victoria is another one of these characters that has got her own agenda, and every time you turn around, she is a step either ahead or behind Hunter, and you really don't get it until the end as to how is it that this FBI agent is so fast on the details but still failing to make an arrest. And that's her secret to reveal at the end.
Well, we're not going to tell what that is either. But we have, I'm going to cross this one out. Who is Saeed?
Well, Saeed is the quintessential bad guy in this. He is one of the focal points of a terrorist cell that's involved in the story. And he's sort of the mastermind behind some of the events that are going on, but not all. And he is sort of he's using Kane, and he's also using a couple other characters to get his way with the refugees. And I want to be careful here. All I'm going to say about Saeed is he's also sort of a real guy, and the way he operates is very real. By the way he approaches the refugees and how he takes advantage of these families and these businesses and how he kind of uses all of this to his gain. And yet he's the guy that never wants to be there when the bomb goes off, which is, you know, very much like a lot of the masterminds. You know, they'll hide in a cave and send everybody else out to die. So that's sort of the character that I created with him.
Sounds like some people in our government too.
Well, I didn't say that.
I know, I've been listening to everything, and then that was kind of wrong yesterday on 9/11. That was really inappropriate what somebody did when they arrived at the one at the Pentagon, and somebody gave everybody a bump instead of saying, I'm sorry. It was really inappropriate.
People don't think.
Some people never think. What can I tell you? Operation Maya is a full-blown terrorist plot, and they use a specific chemical that I've heard about. And Bobby, who wants to be a journalist, wanted to help out. So what is Operation Maya exactly? I don't want to say too much about it.
Yeah, I got to be careful here again too, right? So so Operation Maya, you find out initially when Kevin dies that he gives out some clues about the operation. This is sort of an umbrella for what the entire antagonists are up to throughout the entire story. It's sort of the umbrella word for that. But it's got different meanings to it, too. So as Hunter progresses in both his investigation and his chasing Kane, he starts to find bits and pieces. And every time he thinks he knows exactly what Operation Maya is, he's wrong. And then he goes, well, that I'm wrong about that, so off I go over in this direction. And Maya involves a lot of virtually every character, and it involves the three main antagonists that are here, the Russians, the Iranians, and the Americans. And it's sort of the – if you even get halfway through the book, you're going to realize that this story is fiction, but tonight at 6 o'clock it could become reality because it's based on – real threats. I try to play the threats out in real terms, because it does come from my world, and I'm trying to basically show that if you're going to be a free society like we are, these are the risks. This stuff can happen. It has happened in the past, and it could happen again. But at the same time, it takes a lot of complication to do it. And thank God in our country, we have the absolute, despite what anybody will say, fight them tooth and nail, the absolute best law enforcement, military, and intelligence people in the world, bar none. And that's the only reason we don't get hit more often. And because it's not on the news every day doesn't mean our people are not in the streets combating this. The threats are here. They're here every day. And thank God for the people that we have, because they're the ones keeping us safe. But in order to make a story, you have to have mistakes made. And you have to, you know, to make the story happen, you've got to let the bad guys win a few things. So the Operation Maya is the manipulation of our own system in order to make those events take place. And I'll leave it at that. I think that's probably the best way to describe it.
Well, I'm just sitting and taking notes here, seriously. And I'm thinking, because you're in anti-terrorism and Alan Jacobson is anti-terrorism and my friend FBI agent Mike Tabman knows all about this, I'm thinking about in January to ask you and maybe Alan Jacobson and Mike Tabman and one more person to say, how do you use your career as an anti-terrorist aficionado or FBI or law enforcement person in your writing? How do you incorporate it? How do you use real life? That would be fun, and Mike is fantastic. I've done shows with Mike Tabman. We did the Brussels thing, and we did 9/11. We talked about it on several of my shows. But every time there was an attack somewhere, we were on the air to talk about it, and which is really amazing because I got to learn.
You know, and that's
had the
really
thing in Tribeca too.
You know, that's really really important that we do that. So As you said in the beginning, I'm an international anti-terrorism consultant. Now, I consult in things other than terrorism. I do investigations and threats and things like that. But anti-terrorism is my forte. And it's very different from counter-terrorism, right? So counter-terrorism are the Navy SEALs, the Green Berets. They jump on helicopters, they go into bad places, and they eliminate or capture bad people.
Wow.
My job in anti-terrorism is to help defend against the bad guys, or to investigate failures of our security in order so it doesn't happen again. So the two of those pieces are integral to national security and homeland security, but very, very distinct. And I always make that statement on these kinds of shows or in my writing, because I don't want anybody to think that I'm claiming to be a counterterrorism guy. I'm not. I'm very fortunate that I've got several that work with me all the time. So when I need
to know
something about that world, I can pick up the phone and call Mike and say, hey, Mike, he's a retired Green Beret. When you did this, what can you tell me openly without getting in trouble about how this would work? In my world, I work with private businesses and high net worth people and things like that, and help them defend themselves and work with law enforcement agencies to put up defenses. So in the book, The Consultant, As he moves from this story into my next sequel and book three, he starts to get closer into that world of pure consulting as opposed to, you know, the government guy. And I will play with themes as the series unfolds that some of them are pure consulting in the world that I come from, threats and risks and investigations. So it sort of opens up the opportunity for Hunter to do other things that will be exciting and adventurous other than just chase down a terrorist.
That's exciting. I can't wait. So before we end in about 5 minutes, why is Sam so angry? I'm not going to tell anything. He reminds me of an angry teenager. And teenagers, I'm an expert at teenagers. I have, you know,
me
teenage
too.
Nieces and nephews. it's funny. I have a teenage niece that got in a bit of hot soup in her high school, but I blamed it on both of them. And she's doing very well in a different kind of school. And I'm the only one she won't be disrespectful to, she said. She said, we don't mess with the aunt.
There you go.
Yeah, my nephews are in their two are in their 20s, and one is 18. And they text me on Fridays when I tell them, if you want your birthday present next year, you better let me know you're alive. And they're looking forward to seeing me, actually, on Thanksgiving, because I'm the only lunatic that's going to do Black Friday. And I love it. I'm the crazy aunt with the crazy color hair.
You tell them that I said they are so fortunate to have you, because I grew up without any real aunts or uncles. I had great aunts, and thank God for them. Mm. But I had no real aunts or uncles, you know, just one generation ahead. And I didn't have that large family. And now my kids, I raised, like you, I'm an expert on teenagers. My wife and I, both previously married, glued five kids together, and they were teenagers all at the same time. So you can imagine raising five teenagers in one household for years. And they now have a great relationship, because now a couple of them have had kids. So my grandkids now have a really great mix of aunts and uncles, and I keep telling them, you know, you guys had better appreciate this, because not everybody has this opportunity.
You're right, and I have a niece that's going for nursing school, and guess who's going with her? You got it.
Yeah, I met her. I met her at ThrillerCon, or ThrillerFest,
yeah,
right?
Well,
she was the one you were helping her with some of her research.
Yes, that's Danny Nick, yes, and she went back to school today. She just got diagnosed with diabetes, so she's, you know, was a little late, but I'm sure I'm going to get my homework assignment later. What can I say? I help her do it, and then I'm the homework helper. But before we end, so what's next for John, and who are you bringing back? Are you bringing back Bond and Baquero, or are they gone?
Well, my plan. Let me give you the plan for the. Let me give you the big picture first. So Hunter's back. I finished book two, and it's with my agent getting a review first before we present it to Ocean View Publishing, which is a fantastic publishing outfit.
Yeah, they are.
They just
great.
Won a huge award at Thriller Fest, and I thank them very much for the confidence they've given me. They're also the publisher for Dick Belsky, and half a dozen others that you just named.
Yeah, DP also.
Lyle is with them, and you know, they're a great bunch. So we're waiting to put that forward to them to see what they think, and so that is tentatively titled Provocateur. And in story, Hunter will take on Cuban exiles and Cuban spies, and as a plot to sneak into the United States for some nefarious activities, Hunter accidentally trips over this, and he gets involved with that. But his crisis this time is a crisis of conscience, because he's been sidelined for a year by Oscar LaRue after the consultant. He's injured at the end, and LaRue says, you need to take some time off. You lost your brother. You've now got this family to take care of. Take some time off. Get yourself settled down. And Hunter goes bonkers, right? So in his very first foray back to work, he screws up. And now he's got a confidence problem. He's tripped over this international problem with the Cubans, and he doesn't know what to do. He can't go back to Oscar, so he goes it alone. And, of course, he gets himself into trouble, as always. And that's book two. And I've outlined for book three, going to get going, and I don't want to give anything away on that, because it'll really depend on what Ocean View thinks of book two and how much leverage we get, if they even take it, you know, to go forward with it. But there will be the series. And my interest in Hunter is that periodically, not every book, but throughout the series that I've got planned, different characters may come back. And they don't necessarily come back as who you thought they were the last time.
Oh, good.
Right? Because in book one, The Consultant, I left open air around a lot of characters about who are these people really, and are they good guys or really bad guys, and who are these people? And I didn't answer all the questions intentionally so that they could come and go in Hunter's life and his adventures, and not be boxed in every book to have, okay, well, you already know who this person is, you already know who that person is. No, you're not going to. They're gonna play different roles with Hunter as he goes forward.
Well, I have to say this. If Ocean View doesn't take him, they're gonna have to answer to me.
They're a great
and
bunch.
I'll read it
whenever
you want. I read books before they come out too, and give testimonials, whatever, and I don't charge. But all I could tell you is I work for Partners in Crime, and they send me a lot of books, and I never, even if I don't ask for it, they send it anyway. I'm surprised that Cheryl is not on, because she was on last time when I had to cancel the show. So she's going to be disappointed, but I'll send her the link later.
Let me jump on that real quick with 5 seconds. for any other authors hearing all this. One, this is a wonderful show, and I love Fran. But I tell you what, Partners in Crime is a great bunch who do promotions and blog tours and virtual tours for authors. They do a terrific job, an absolute terrific job, and they are a pleasure to work with. And I'm not just saying that because they got me on the air with you, but I've thoroughly enjoyed working with them because they've given me an opportunity to do so many different things that other blog tours I've been at have not given me quite the same number of opportunities. So I recommend them highly to anybody.
They did mine too. They did mine too. For my daughter's promise. And before I end, I got to tell everybody, Friday at 9:30, guest is going to be interviewed on 1270 AM, 98.1 FM for a daughter's promise. That would be me on the mic pump, open mic. I don't know what they're going to ask, but I am totally honored that I'm going to be interviewed about my mom's book.
So that is terrific. I'm out of town, but I'm going to try to get to it. I'm sure they'll have it posted afterwards, right?
I don't know. I hope so. I have no idea. Open mic. It could be on podcast. It could be. It's live. It's going to be live, I think.
Well, I hope I can catch it. Congratulations. That sounds fantastic.
It is. Well, that's thanks to Edit Pros, my publisher. But thank you so much. I want everyone to have a beautiful day. It's not snow. It's not raining anymore, but it's going to. Everybody have a great day. Thank you so much, TJ. I can't wait for the next one. Hope to see you again next year at the Thriller Fest if they have me. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you, Fran.